inside the feral zone.
Greetings, listeners. Welcome back inside the feral zone of the Troubled Men podcast. I'm Renee Komen, sitting here in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Klempire. As many of you may know, the Feral Zone is a sister podcast of the Troubled Men podcast. It shows up in the space from time to time when circumstances call for. This is one of those times. Tonight I have a terrific guest that I've known for many, many years. He's happens to be in New Orleans. It was a surprise to me. He didn't know why he was here. I discovered yesterday that he had played a gig at Tipitina's with the great Charlie Halloran and the Tropicals and John Cleary. He was on that bill, so had a night off here, and we slipped in a Feral Zone. So he's a beloved songwriter, singer, guitar player, band leader, and radio show host. He's had his several bands, the Milwaukeeans, as well as Tomorrow Sound, over his career. He's put out over a dozen records since 1986. His latest solo record is a self-titled record. Came out in September. Continues to host his weekly Way Back Home radio show on WMSE in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which he's done since 1985, I believe. He's also a very snappy dresser, and has a very cool vintage cheap guitar collection. And without further ado, the great Mr. Paul Seabar. Welcome. Hey, welcome, Paul.
Hey, good to see you.
Yeah, man. Good to have you here.
I'm glad
now,
to be here.
Have you been in Snake and Jake's before?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Although I think it was a few modifications ago.
Okay, yeah, the ceiling used to be lower. Since the ceiling has been raised, it has even more of a sort of Narnia effect that you look at it from outside and it seems like a tool shed, and then you come in and it looks way bigger than you could have imagined. And of course, very red in here. It's
very,
always also like
fitting.
Very David Lynchian, you know, the red room,
yeah.
Whatever.
Let's rock,
man. So, as I was saying, is that why you were in town to do that gig?
I came into town to celebrate Christmas with Michael Burke and Stacy and their whole gang of people.
Oh, okay. So it just worked out that... Now, how do you know Charlie?
Charlie, I've been a big fan of since I first saw them playing.
Oh, okay.
And I realized we were kind of coming from some very, very similar Caribbean orientation.
Yeah, it looks like you guys dress out of the same closet, I would say.
I think, yeah, I think same. You can wear the smaller ones.
Yeah. You could shop at the same vintage store anyway. Yeah. You wouldn't cross paths. You'd say, you find a medium, you go, here you go, Charlie.
There you go.
That's when sizes were real, you know. You didn't have, like now you probably wear a medium and he wears a small and a modern clothes, you know, but... That's when size was before
right.
Size inflation.
When you were looking for those 16 and a half.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what a large is supposed to be. Well, cool. So, you got down here. And as I said, we've known each other for years. We first met, I think, through Derek Houston when Derek was still playing in the Iguanas. And
I think so.
And, Iguanas and your band, Paul Seabar and the Milwaukeeans was playing at that time, and it was back in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of shows together through the Midwest and beyond. Now, we might have covered this in the first show, and for those who want to hear the full get the full spectrum of Paul Seabar information, you first appeared on Troubled Men Podcast 121 on September 10th in 2020.
Right.
So,
we were all squirming around our homes.
All locked down, yes. We were 9 months in or 6 months into lockdown, which we thought was going to be 6 weeks, obviously. It was quite a bit longer, but we did a remote podcast with you over the computers there, and you had your I think it's actually called Paul Seabar's Tomorrow Sound was the title of that episode, if anybody wants to go back and check it out. And that's actually the name of your current band, Tomorrow Sound.
Right.
Now, how did you and Derek meet?
We met down here at Jazz Fest, at Eddie's restaurant on Law Street, which had incredibly great fried chicken,
okay,
but also great gumbo.
Right,
and
I remember
a wonderful
place.
Jukebox.
A jukebox. Okay, I kind of remember the story now.
And so Derek, I think, was probably still underage. I was still overage.
Yeah.
And but we kept seeing each other at the same gigs. You know, we were all trying to see Jesse Hill and,
okay,
you know, everybody who was still around.
Right, right.
And at some point, we found ourselves at the jukebox, and kind of Derek said, I've seen you at every place I've been. What's your story?
Okay.
And we kind of...
And he saw your...
good friends.
Your sartorial inclinations,
I think that might have had something to do
sure,
with it.
Sure, the hipster vibe.
We might have had similar buttons on the shirt.
Okay, so, yeah, I could see that. Some Decton shirts or something. Yeah, yeah. Well, so for the people, let's do a quick recap. You're not from New Orleans. You are from Milwaukee.
That's right.
Okay, hence the name of your first band, the Milwaukeeans.
That's right.
So grew up there, mom and dad, siblings?
Yep. Both mom and dad were teachers.
Okay.
Mother quit, or she had to quit when she had me in that day and age.
Right.
And when my sister is about a year and a half younger than I, so my sister Mary, and once we reached teenage years, mom went back and became a paraprofessional aide, and then Mary subsequently became a public school teacher.
Okay, very nice.
So I'm the one guy that stepped out of the family business and stepped
right
into a much more ridiculous one. With their support, I must add.
Okay, well, that's good, because not everybody has that, but they were looking for someone to do something other than teach, perhaps.
I think, oddly enough, they would have accepted whatever the heck I was planning on doing.
Nice, nice. So when do you first start getting interested in music? How does that come about?
Well, I didn't play till quite late, till I was about 18. But I'm 69, if I can believe it, but
right,
it's true.
It happens, man.
Yeah. So I was not old enough to be like going through post-puberty antics when the Beatles came out, but I was completely alarmed and charmed by the whole British thing, and
right,
I didn't quite know what they were singing about, but it was, I loved it.
Okay.
And I loved, you know, everything that came after, you know, the Temptations. Milwaukee's, you know, an hour and a half north of Chicago.
Right.
So there was a great, you know, Chicago soul was very, very much there, and Motown was thriving. So, you know, there were day shows that were on, showing all these crazy new bands. You know, the Birds had the longest bangs.
Okay.
I remember that was very pivotal for me that day on whatever Lloyd Thaxton or whatever it was.
Okay.
But, you know, the music came through the radio back then. I mean, I was a little too young. There were some really good soul bands. It was Harvey Scales and Twist and Harvey Scales and the Seven Sounds and Vic Pitts and the Cheaters. And a whole mess of others that, I'm trying to think of another.
Those were Midwestern bands?
Those were Milwaukee soul bands. But the Esquires, who had Get On Up, they were from Milwaukee.
Oh, okay.
And so they recorded in Chicago, but they were a Milwaukee band.
Right. It's crazy how much music comes out of the Midwest, man. You know, we had this guy Mark Guarino on. I'm sure you know Mark. You know, wrote this whole book on
that book's great.
Country and Midwestern. Yeah, it's a terrific book. Yeah, anybody that hasn't read it, definitely check it out. But yeah, you hear the whole tradition of country music there going back to the 20s and, you know, all these bluegrass bands recording there in Chicago. And yeah. Besides just blues, which everybody kind of thinks about, you know, electric blues. But,
you know, the whole picture of people going to Nashville, but also like coming up to Chicago and Milwaukee to work.
Right.
Because those are real, you know, machine shop kind of places.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, everybody came to, yeah, work in all those factories and stuff.
Yeah. And we definitely were part of the Great Black Migration in Milwaukee.
Right.
There's a lot of, you know, auto parts and auto work stuff going on and smelt. I mean, they were doing every horrible job you could do.
Right, right.
But I, you know, I caught the radio bug, and so, you know, you'd be up late at night trying to get this thing called Beaker Street that came out of like Little Rock.
Okay.
But it was a large enough station that it would get there at
yeah,
night.
Yeah, clear channel, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And I do recall listening to John R. every once in a while at the LAC, but I didn't really know where to find that. But Chicago and Milwaukee stations were blasting everything that was coming out.
Right, so that was all coming into your head. Now, I read somewhere that you fell in with some family that had some kind of amazing record collection.
The Murphys.
Okay. The Murphys. Shout out to the Murphys.
Yeah, they were friends of... There's a great... an artist in Milwaukee named Carl Preby. And Carl was a... He's kind of become known for floral portraits and then portraits of African Americans, and he was a big habitué of the sort of the black neighborhood, the Bronzeville of Milwaukee, which was Walnut Street. And
first time that word's been used on the podcast, by the way.
Habitué.
Yeah, yeah. So gold star for you.
All right, we're
go
working.
On.
I'll keep trying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Keep spitting them out, man.
But Carl was on the scene, so he was like very close to Billie Holiday.
Oh, nice.
And so he had an amazing collection of 78s and 45s and some albums that, when he died, he left to his brother, who was a Catholic brother. And this Catholic brother was a big friend of the Murphy family.
Okay.
Where I first saw Preby's, you know, he had a bunch of his artwork all over their house. But when the brother died, he left Carl's whole collection to the Murphy family. And I was going to high school with the youngest of them. And so I started getting in on these parties at their house. And then all of a sudden I was like, whoa, man, I don't even know what this stuff is.
Mind being blown even further.
Yeah, it was, you know, like, not like one Louis Jordan record, but 17 Louis Jordan records.
Okay.
And, you know, a whole mess of Buddy Johnson. I mean, Rosetta Tharpe, including the crazy record where they recorded her wedding.
Yeah.
At a stadium.
Oh, okay.
And it was like big news.
Right.
But, you know, this was in, I don't know, like early 80s maybe.
Okay.
No, early 70s.
Right, yeah,
sorry.
yeah.
Late 70s. This is when I met these people.
Now, I've read conflicting reports about when you first saw the Wild Magnolias.
Yeah.
I read one place where it said it was on a college break, and another place where it said you were 11 years old at the same arts festival.
Yeah, it was a Lakefront Festival of the Arts, and I think by looking on the internet, I realized that it had to have been when I came back from college.
Okay, right. You try to reconstruct these things in the through the mists of time.
Right. I mean, it was a very pivotal day.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a thing where they had jazz there often. There was a guy that had a show on the AM radio in Milwaukee named John Grams. And he was kind of a rakish, he's probably my age now, but I thought of him as quite an elderly guy, but very kind of stylish,
right.
Little snap brim hat.
Uh-huh.
And he'd have like a Madras jacket on, and he'd be introducing whoever he had. So in previous years, I had seen like Helen Humes and Red Norvo, and I'm trying to think of who else. Pretty amazing, you know, jazz musicians, actual you know, veterans of the whole thing.
Right.
And I know my friend John Seeger, who I was in the R&B Cadets with, he went down and saw Bola Seche there, the great Brazilian guitar player.
Right.
Which is, you know, right on the lakefront in Milwaukee in the summertime.
Uh-huh.
It must have been tremendous.
Sure, sure.
But this one year, they announced their schedule, and that one day, it was the Wild Magnolias, Olatunji, the Nigerian percussionist guy.
Uh-huh.
And then Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers.
Oh, nice.
And this was Blakey with, like, Bobby Watson and Billy Pierce. That era, like maybe John Hicks or something.
I played with Bobby Watson at the several of the Hawaiian jazz festivals that the Iguanas go back to year after year. The first couple, Bobby was on both of those. Yeah, what a sweetheart. What a great player, man.
Oh, my God. He was wonderful.
Still is.
And yeah. And I was at that point, I had a professor that was teaching jazz. He was a jazz pianist. He had done his PhD on like Chinese opera music. Hmm. And the joke was that if you went over there and saw Ron playing that music, that he might not be playing it in the speed that it was recorded.
Okay.
But he was a very enthusiastic guy that kind of built the fire under you to want to hear jazz.
All right.
And I had a bunch of guys. I went to school in Florida, this school that's being dismantled now by their DeSantis.
Huh, is that some sort of experimental school?
Yeah, it's called New College.
New College,
in Sarasota.
And what was the driving ethos behind that? Why is it being dismantled?
Well, it's woke as hell. Man.
Okay, all right.
I came up in high school in like a non-graded sort of, you know, individually directed.
Oh, okay.
It was like very few students in a class. So if you're going to read Proust, you'd read Proust with eight people.
Okay, well, that's good because, you know, you get a lot of attention and, you know, it's like you can't get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
It's,
I mean, you can't hide either.
Yeah.
You got to really read it.
Right, okay.
So I really loved going there. But one of the things that people were from the East and from the out West, and there weren't a lot of Midwesterners. And all of them came with record collections. I really didn't have one at the time.
Uh-uh.
And, you know, they could. I had, my dearest friend, he showed up with, you know, Ry Cooder and Taj Mahal the first day I got there.
Mm.
And I hadn't heard either of them. And they've been like coming out my lodestars sort of ever since.
Yeah.
So, I was really curious and I started buying stuff around then. But then I came home and I encountered this whole collection. And at the time, I just started playing guitar. So I was, you know, I was playing Neil Young and Bob Dylan and mm-hmm. whoever else I happened upon. And learning, you know, going to see John Fahey or something. And see,
right.
Getting ideas for what I might want to do. And then I started playing with these guys that were familiar with all kinds of music. And I think that's really what kind of lit the fire for guitar, was being able to play with other guys.
Sure.
And, you know, pick up parts of their repertoire and you figure out ways, how's John Hurt doing that?
Right, right. You know. And so you're in college, but then you go back and you see the Wild Magnolias and you get really turned on to the idea of New Orleans as a sort of mecca.
Yeah. And even, you know, when I think about it now, I mean, it was probably Bo Dallas, and it may have been the Magnolias. What's the other guy? The guy that's still around that's doing it.
Monk Boudreau?
Monk, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Big Chief Monk Boudreau.
Yeah, he was from...
The Chief of Chiefs.
He's of a different tribe, but I think he toured with that group.
Yes, yes. He's been in and out of several organizations over all of his
whole
Indian
career. But, they really, they didn't travel. You know, it wasn't like... It was probably the era where the Willie T record was out,
mm-hmm.
or one of those two. But they weren't traveling with a band, so they were traveling with, you know, tambourines.
Just doing chanting and the big drums.
Right, and bringing, you know, like walking the grounds of the art festival and having you know, us kids following him.
Right.
You know, sitting, I'm Big Chief, got a golden crown. I only knew it live.
Okay.
So when I heard it on record, I was like, that's not how it goes. You know, I mean, it was really powerful.
Yeah.
And I liked that whole thing of just drums and vocals. That's continued to be pretty pivotal for me. And when I look back on my other records, I mean, every record I think there's an innovation and I'm doing something like that. But then I go back to the other ones and there's always one that's doing that anyway.
Yeah, and I was noticing, I was listening again to this record today, and you have this tune, Keep On Looking Like That.
Yeah.
Which kind of incorporates a lot of that kind of chant and gospel influence. And
Yeah, thank you. That's what I was hoping is in there.
Yeah, man, absolutely.
I think of that day as pivotal in the sense that, I mean, there was the whole New Orleans thing. There was the vocal and drum thing. Then Olatunji's band at the time was very much like what Oludara's band was, you know, 20, 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole chain of things with African music and kind of this funky soul thing.
Right.
I've been trying to follow those
sure,
guys
yeah,
forever.
Yeah. that's really interesting.
You know, and then, you know, Blake, yeah, I had never seen him. And, you know, it was quite exciting to see that band. I would never say that I'm...
A band that plays jazz so viscerally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
It's a lot. It's very bloody experience. There's nothing ivory tower about yeah, what goes on.
It was on the other end of the John Lewis spectrum.
Uh-huh, right. Yeah.
But it was quite a day, you know.
Okay. I know you start coming down to Jazz Fest pretty early on, huh?
Yeah, I made my first trip to New Orleans from Sarasota. I think it was probably 78, either 77 or 78, and with some of us borrowed a car and came here and then broke down with the car and got stuck for a week.
Okay.
So it was kind of good. At the time, I was, you know, playing acoustic guitar and trying to learn how to play, so I had a little repertoire that had grown when I discovered that family's collection.
Okay.
And I also, what I was kind of saying was that, you know, you start out learning folk music or whatever was had grown out of folk music, and you know you learn your Dylan tunes. I mean, I got to school the year that Blood on the Tracks came out.
Nice.
So that was
it's a big year.
A good year.
Yeah.
And
That's the first Dylan record that I had.
And, me too.
And people, I've heard a couple of people say, "Oh, well, like my wife doesn't like Dylan." I was like, well, I could teach her to like Dylan. The first thing I do is play Blood on the Tracks, you know, because through that, I can get you in. I can get you into all the stuff after that, all the stuff before that.
You're going to make me lonesome when you go.
Oh, yeah.
How is she going to not like
that? I know.
Flowers on the hillside blooming crazy. Yeah. But so, the idea, I was probably coming here to try, and I found the Penny Post, which was on Ferret Street,
mm-hmm.
somewhere, actually directly across the street from where Mac Perkins, who was my percussionist for many years,
uh-huh.
he had grown up right there.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, it was, I think there was a thrift shop, too, like Kitty Corner from the Penny Post.
Uh-huh.
But I, you know, at the time, I didn't know what was going on here. I mean, I should have been trying to see Long Hair, but I didn't know about him.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so I did read in the paper though that there was this guy that was going to play at Tipitina's on the Sunday, and he was getting ready to go on a European tour, and they said something about he was a military veteran or something, and you know, it was this kind of tale about how he's catching on in Europe. So I thought, well, it's Sunday, I'm here, I'll go over there. And Tipitina's at the time was like a pageant of just wild folks.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, I was at a hippie school, you know, so this was sort of analogous, but it had also this whole urban kind of hipster thing going on.
Right. The ceilings were low. You could smell the bathrooms from everywhere.
Those Indian sandals with the little one toe that's got a thing on it.
Sure.
I remember that being a factor.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was a smaller place, you know, that whole front end of the building. You grew up here, you know, the whole story. Mm-hmm. But I felt like all the walks of life had come through. It was James Booker was playing, but he was playing solo Hammond organ, so he was set up right in the corner playing Hammond, and then everybody's coming milling around, going, "Whoa." And I mean, it was wonderful.
That was a great thing to see. If you're just going to see a couple of things,
it
doesn't get much more New Orleans than that, man. Especially in the New Orleans combined with the avant-garde and the harebrained element, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It
was a good thing. We saw many glances at the New Orleans that I would come to love, but I didn't quite know what I was doing. But we were right off of Valance. Or right off a magazine on Valance, on the other side of it from where Benny's was eventually.
Okay.
But
so right there in the neighborhood, man, 13th Ward, whatever that is.
Yeah, it was fantastic. But I didn't get back until I'm pretty sure it was 1981 because I was finishing my thesis in 80.
And okay.
I don't think I could have gotten away for the Jazz Fest while I was doing that. So that's the first one I came to, and I've come to all of them since then.
Nice.
I'm definitely the guy that's got the hook in his lip.
Sure, sure.
You can tell Quint that his message got through, at least one guy.
You know, Quint has done so much, man. I've talked about this multiple times, but, you know, people mostly know Quint for, oh, well, you know, he started the Jazz Fest, or, you know, he did this other thing. But just, you know, being instrumental in Professor Longhair's resurgence and taking him all around, that would have been enough. Kind of being the impetus to suggest that they combine New Orleans electric funk with Mardi Gras Indian chants.
Yeah, I mean, he's behind the Wild Magnolias record, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it was his idea. You guys should get together.
Even Honda Wanda sounds like he even paid for it or was there doing it.
No, he was balls deep and all that stuff, as they say.
I mean, Allison, too, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. And she, you know, she doesn't get enough credit, but Allison Miner. Yeah, she was right there, right there with him doing all that stuff.
I remember the first interviews that I heard out there where she was doing them.
Yeah.
And I mean, where they ultimately named the place after her.
Yes.
But I mean, she was tremendous.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So you
enough
go
of that stuff.
Yeah, you go back to Milwaukee and you start the Milwaukee. Oh, no, you have the R&B Cadets.
Yeah, I had my own little acoustic jump band that was playing, you know, that repertoire, the Louis Jordan, Buddy Johnson, maybe writing a few instrumentals or something.
Okay.
And trying to figure out how to write.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had that going for a little while, and I had a great tenor player named Rip Tenor that was tremendous. And he kind of upped my game immediately because I listen to tapes now, and it's like I was playing with a grown-up.
Yeah.
You know, he was happening. And we had a really nice thing going. But then I was curious about, how bands worked. And I met Robin Plour, who I ended up working with a long time. And she said, "Hey, I'm playing with these guys down in, they're in Kenosha. We're going to rehearse this week or something. And I don't know if you want to. We're going to do this gig at this club. This guy had started a club. He wanted to book Nico, O.V. Wright, and all kinds of crazy shit. And so I did a gig there with Jonathan Richmond, and Gordon Gano was just out of high school.
Oh, cool.
So it was Gordon, and then I did a solo set, and then Jonathan played.
Nice. Now Gordon Gano from Violent Femmes, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, including if you are a Violent Femme aficionado out there,
Sure. I think a lot of people like the violent films.
The guy in the shorts underneath the beauty parlor helmet on the back of the blind leading the naked is me.
Oh, okay. All right.
And I'm also singing on the Children of the Revolution with them.
Oh, cool.
But I actually gave them gigs. It's in one of those situations.
Oh, okay.
We played, my little band, we played at this place called the Jazz Gallery. And they were in that period where they were busking and they couldn't really find places.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the guy at the gallery, you know, these guys are good, you know, try them on a Tuesday or something.
Right on. Good for you.
So it was, I mean, he was full blown coming out of high school.
Yeah.
Gordon was really writing.
Yeah.
And really funny.
Yeah.
Extremely funny guy.
Yeah.
In a very completely deadpan way.
Right, right. Yeah, that was a great band, man. You know, and yes, I remember the first record is Fully Formed, man. Yeah, it comes out. And I guess when Chrissy Hynde discovered them out on the street, they were already like that. Just
They were out front of the Oriental Theater, which is one of our big movie theater palaces.
Right.
Along with the Downer. It's the only town with the Downer Theater.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know that one.
Yeah, there was an early judge that was named Jason Downer. So we have Downer Avenue, where the Downer Theater.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're writing more. You decide you're going to start your own band at some point.
I went to this rehearsal with the R&B Cadets, and I had just found that Howard Tate record at the Kmart for like 39 cents, mm-hmm. along with a Meters record. The Fire on the Bayou Meters record.
Yeah.
And so I just found those, and I went down to this rehearsal, and the first thing they were learning was Ain't Nobody Home from the Howard Tate record. So I thought, yeah, that's
for you.
I'd like to work with these guys.
Okay.
And they were doing it. They'd been in bands, and they had it. And John was writing a lot of original music, and I was now exploring and finding all kinds of 45s and stuff. So I became the guy that found the covers that we were going to do. Then John would write the new stuff.
Okay, because you do have an encyclopedic knowledge of music all across all these roots genres, from American roots music to African roots music and Caribbean stuff. And
yeah, I got caught the fever.
All right.
And at that point, it was probably soul and R&B and New Orleans R&B. And
right,
stuff.
Right. Well, yeah. I guess, yeah. You always...
I'd found maybe a couple Sparrow records or something, so I was off into Calypso too, but we weren't really playing that. But then, I brought in all these... I'm a giant Lee Dorsey fan, so I would be the guy that would sing, like, work, 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 and all the flip sides of it. The Greatest Love one, a whole mess of tunes.
Nice.
That would be my job was... I self-appointed Lee Dorsey man.
Right. You know, this seems like it'd be a good time to take a little break here and refresh our cocktails.
Yes.
And everybody out there in the Feral Zone knows what to do. And go get yourself another drink, and we'll be right back.
We put a lot behind us when we sing. We bring a lot to the table when we sing. Things heavy in our mind, slings and arrows, of course words and angry tones, they fall by the wayside when we sing.
And we're back with our guest, Mr. Paul Seabar. I am Renee Coleman. Now, Paul, I know you're familiar with the show. You understand the show is a listener-supported operation. We have no corporate sponsorship, but we do have our devoted listeners who use the links in the show notes of every show or the Facebook page. We have links for the Venmo and PayPal accounts. And this week, we have support from a guy we already mentioned on the podcast, Mr. Mark Guarino, the great journalist and writer and all-around good guy. And so Mark is sponsoring our cocktails tonight, and as well as another guy, Andrew Aronson, was contributed to through the Venmo link. So I want to give a shout-out to both of those fellas. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we also have the links to the Patreon page in those show notes, and we have a handful of patrons that support us week in and week out. Also, we have the link to the Troublemen Podcast t-shirts there. And we also say follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars. Helps us a lot. Costs you nothing. And you can always find my dates on iguanas.com or on my Renee Coleman Facebook page, which I have a link to there in the show notes. And Iguanas, Paul, you were asking about this Sunday, whether the Iguanas were playing at the legendary Carousel Bar in the Hotel Monteleone. The answer is yes.
Yes, and indeed.
We have, our residency has been indefinitely extended.
Yeah,
so we will be there every Sunday from 7 to 10. And man, it's been a great gig for us this past weekend. It's all the holiday revelry, and it was packed out, and it's really starting to, on certain nights, it feels like, I imagine, like the Butera, the Sam Butera, or the Louis Prima lounge shows would be in Vegas, where everybody shows up, they're sitting down, but they're all totally focused on the band. You know, the energy in the room is electric. You know, it's crazy, man. I mean, I don't want to oversell it. Maybe it's not like that every time, but now it's this past weekend. It's like, wow, this is. I just get certain flashes come into my mind. It's like, I feel like I'm
the meters at the Ivanhoe.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I don't want to. Oversell it, but. But yeah, it's been a great scene. So yes, Paul, I hope you'll come see us there. And when people like a Paul Seabar come in and see us, we'll say, Paul, why don't you get up and do a few tunes with us? And you're one of those guys who has gotten up and done a few tunes with the Iguanas since the first time we ever played together. So, not only do you slay, we've done it many times before. And
it's true.
And so
it's always been a blast.
Yeah. We've had such a copacetic relationship between you and the Iguanas. You know, it's really been a beautiful thing, man. And you have that kind of thing with a lot of people. You know, I was thinking about this today. Like you have many stellar fans. You know, Joe Ely was a big fan of yours and a collaborator, I guess. You know,
we were always planning to collaborate, but we never really did. And I mean, he was just a tremendous fellow.
Yeah, man, it's a terrible loss there.
Yeah.
Bonnie Raitt, another big supporter of yours. In fact, I saw somewhere in the news or social media somewhere, a concert of hers where she was holding up this new record of yours, which is, I was saying, it's self-titled. It is called Paul Seabar.
Yeah.
And sometimes they would say an eponymously titled record.
Yeah, that's right. That's what we're going with.
Yeah. No, so, and this is maybe like your 13th record or something in your career, and so finally
close
enough.
I'm claiming it. Yeah.
Right. So you finally have one that's just Paul Seabar. Now, would you consider this a solo record?
It's actually a full band record.
Full band record.
It was done partly over the lockdown, and also in kind of fits and starts, but it was largely done in Chicago with this guy, Alex Hall, who's tremendous.
Okay, I'm not familiar with him, but he plays great, and the record sounds amazing, man. I think the record is really excellent.
Thank you.
You know, it's a really varied bunch of material. It all sounds really very natural and warm and not overworked and not overwrought.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes by quickly, which I think is always a good thing in a record, because that means it's not bogging down at any point. You know, the narrative is flowing, and you put it on and you're like, everything is like, oh, that sounds great. It sounds great. And then it's over, you know, like, and there's 11 songs on it. It's not a short record, but
yeah.
So well done, man.
I'm glad it sounds like that on your end. That's what we were hoping.
Now, this guy, Alex Hall, I noticed some of his credits. One is Nick Lowe, or he has some sort of association with Nick Lowe, which is another big supporter of yours.
No, we've been close to him for a long time. And
yeah.
Nobody better than to be close to him.
Hey, man.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
If nothing else, you'll be endlessly amused.
Yeah, okay.
Hanging around with
right.
him. He's a wonderful guy. And we'd opened shows for him as far back as the R&B Cadets, and he had seen us play. And,
oh, wow.
And he actually produced a song on the R&B Cadets record, which just came out on Twin Tone.
Oh, okay.
Right near the end of the band, but it was like 86, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we've maintained our friendship. And
nice.
You know, he actually sang background on an earlier record, but... he wasn't involved musically on this one.
Okay. But. Well, another group that Alex Hall I saw has an association with is the Cactus Blossoms.
Yeah, yeah.
And I first became aware of them when they appeared in one season of the reboot of Twin Peaks,
yeah.
The David Lynch thing that came out on Showtime. Now it's probably 10 years ago at this point. It might be
right.
8 or something. But it was when they would have a band play a full song on each episode, and one was these two tall brothers singing this real moody music, kind of Everly Brothers-esque.
Yeah.
And then the Iguanas played this folk festival in Canada.
Vancouver or something?
Yes, yeah, I think it was. And they were on the bill, and so I got to hang around with them a lot.
They're great guys.
They are great.
They're out of Minneapolis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we actually borrowed their Wurlitzer.
Oh, I did see that credit.
Yeah.
So you have like your regular bass player Mike Fredrickson plays on most of the record.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Hall plays drums on most of it, although Reggie Bordeaux, your longtime drummer, plays on a few tracks.
Right. Right.
And you have Bob Jennings, your saxophone player and keyboard player, also plays on a bunch of stuff. But then you have some other people coming in, and I guess that's the thing when you're during lockdown, everybody's locked down wherever they are, and you're somewhere, and you're like, well,
yeah. I mean, it made for kind of varied recording.
Mm-hmm.
I did a bunch of recording at home that we brought into the studio. I did a few things where it's just Alex and I. Kind of cooking it up, and then we eventually augmented it.
And man, for doing it like that, it sounds remarkably consistent. It doesn't sound like a patched together bunch of material.
No, I've been really taken with what Alex does with whoever he's been with. He's done these two records for the Flat Five that he's also a member of that band.
Oh, okay.
And
that's the guy that's the band that Casey McDonough is in.
Casey and Scott Legan, who both play with NRBQ now.
Oh, okay. Scott is the guitar player.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw those guys with the Iguanas or something at Fitzgerald's.
Oh, yeah.
And I met Casey, and Casey and I got along so well. He stayed through the whole Iguana set, and then we hung out for like 2 hours at Fitzgerald's after that.
He's a king among men, Casey McDonough.
Yeah, man.
They're wonderful guys. Scott Legan is actually on the record.
Right, I saw that.
On a couple of tunes. But Alex has produced them. He's produced the Cactus Blossoms. He produced J.D. McPherson. He engineered that first one, Jimmy Sutton, I think, is credited as the producer.
Okay.
But he's done a bunch of JD's stuff.
Nice.
And he works the studio that was Jimmy Sutton's that he had built. It's now called Reliable Recorders, and that's where Alex works.
Okay.
And Alex is just a chameleonic, you know, he can, whatever drum feel you're thinking about, he's already thought about that and figured out how to get it.
Yeah.
And we just had a wonderful time working on the record. And he has a really great sense of how to make it, you know, how there can be variety, but also, you know, a sense of a place. And he actually has almost like a time stamp that kind of makes you think, you don't think, well, this is 61 or 68 or something, but you think this is from a good time.
Yeah.
This music is from a good, you know, we're kind of building a...
Right.
You know, it's conscious of the past, but it has this real sense of like, you know, I like to be there, wherever that is.
I was listening to today, and I was like, Tana, what's the band that did Crystal Blue Persuasion?
Tommy James.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, yeah. Because you have a song that really kind of is that kind of like soul, jazz, moody.
Probably Sunday Ride.
Yeah, Sunday Ride. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that was really like one of the surprising ones of the whole process.
Okay.
It was early in the, you know, it was right after the vaccinations came out, and so we could work again.
Mm.
But it was, we were like, we weren't sure you were supposed to, you know, so I had Alex there and myself, and we were going to experiment with some things that I brought from home. And then Scott Legan was going to come in to do that day. And we're going to see what we came up with. And so that was a thing where I brought a guitar part that I had recorded at home on my phone. I mean,
oh, right.
Right,
that's
straight
the one.
Out of voice memos. And it was, you know, late at night, Cynthia would be sleeping and I'd be out there, you know. I had an open tuned, like kind of baritone Dan Electro copy, and and it's kind of like, I don't know, solid Joni Mitchell land, you know, in terms of the tuning. So I became a little problematic trying to figure out how to play it live now, but it, you know, we had this kind of atmospheric thing. I thought if anybody can cut this up and make it work, it's Alex. So I brought it along.
Mm-hmm.
Along with like a, you know, a stack of notebooks at a whole mess of lyrics. And so I said, oh, I got this lyric. I don't know if it'll work with this, but I'm kind of thinking maybe we'll try this. And there was this crazy day where we had been in Detroit. We played and we were driving home in the van, coming home from Detroit.
This with Tomorrow Sound, your regular four-piece band?
We were still called the Milwaukee Incident.
Oh, okay, oh, okay.
But, you know, it was... This lyric was written about 25 years ago, you know, coming back.
So you have all those notebooks of old lyrics that you still go back.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a brilliant move. That's something, that's a Burroughs move, where you keep all your shit and you go back and you keep re-editing it.
Yeah, I mean, this was, oddly enough, it was really like, it was in stanzas, and it was, I'd always imagined I was going to figure out, you know, what I was going to play and make it up someday, but I never did. And so, but I knew I had it. And I mean, we were driving back from Detroit. It was the first day of autumn, but it was 75 degrees and beautiful and like wild, like crazy flowing clouds. And
yeah.
You know, the corns like up, you know, up your head. And it was like, you know, there was no reason to feel, exalted. You know, we really had like, we never really caught on in Detroit. And I love going there.
It's a tough city, man.
I have a lot of friends there.
Sure.
But, you know, we had a reasonably good gig. You know, I wasn't losing too much money by paying everybody.
Right.
And so, you know... For some reason, it was a moment of like really just exaltation. You know, we're driving, I'm seeing all these things, you know, this giant tire that's welcoming you.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, I see these guys pulled off on the side of the road, and the guy's got like a brown, like brown leather colored Cadillac, and he gets out of the Cadillac and he's got a brown leather suit that matches his car.
Wow.
And his license plate says Mr. Jazz. And then I go about a mile down the road and there's a guy who's got his motorcycle that's got like flat, it's got matte black saddlebags, and it's got a matte black leather cover on the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And he's got the same suit on. And he's just right there. They're both on the side of the road.
Wow, this must be like a thing, man.
This is like a Sunday. And so that's what I wrote, these, you know, this crazy thing. You know, Mr. Jazz is riding too, with his burnished fringe on the matte black tip. And it's off to fall just before the colors and the sickly slide. We're purring, whining, and thinking wide on this Sunday ride.
Yeah,
and I had written that, and I had written about the welcoming tire, and then corns head high, everything's hanging on. It'll be bonfires and jackets and dragging along. But now it's shirt sleeves and a brand new breeze in a flicking green time. And then it's off to fall again.
Nice.
But I had this thing, and, you know, so Alex cut the guitar part up so that it was like, I don't know, 3 minutes long. And
mm-hmm.
Then he said, well, let's go see what we get, you know. And I said, well, I'll try singing this against it and see if it works. So he turned the tape on. He went out to the drums. Scott went to the organ. They turned the organ on. And then they put, he, you know, 15 seconds later or something, the guitar starts up.
Mm-hmm.
They both kick in and start doing it. And then I just sang the thing. And, I mean, it's really substantially the first take.
Wow.
We went back in and, you know, sang a couple things again, I think.
Right.
Maybe I did a few, like, Brenton Wood kind of attempts.
Right,
you
but
know,
it was
octave up,
but conceived right in the moment, as far as the totality of the musical concept.
Yeah, I mean it was well, all of us we did it, and then we were like, how did that happen?
Right. It's when yeah. stuff like that happens. I've worked with people where you're like, wow, that was so easy. Let's go on to the next thing. And they're like, let's not fuck the muse. Maybe we should just stop there.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Let's not get greedy.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, it oddly enough, it does echo a lot of my favorite kind of things. You know, there's elements of that kind of, you know, group. Those kind of sixth chords or something, or
right.
minor or major sevenths or something.
Right.
And then, you know, people hear the organ, and my other great friend said, oh, it's Rascals, man. It's the Rascals.
Okay.
You know, so, I mean, it's nice. Everybody's hearing all their favorites. And
yeah,
that, so.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, it's definitely puts you in a time space, you know,
yeah.
And you're like, oh, wow, yeah, this is, it's very soothing. I thought the whole record was very comforting. You know, it felt familiar while at the same time being new and completely inventive and everything. And but
that's good, I think.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah. No, it's great. Now I noticed that you have a couple of co-writes from a guy I've done a good bit of playing with, great Pat McLaughlin.
Yes.
Now, how did that happen?
Well, I've been a giant fan. I saw him for the first time in Austin, Texas, actually, during one of the South by Southwest mm-hmm. where we went down, which was quite a while ago. And he was there at the time. I think he had Billy Bremner in his band. And,
yeah.
And Ian McClagan. And, I mean, it was like, and then Carlo.
And Carlo. Yeah. Nucio. Yeah.
And that was the first time I saw Carlo play. And or no, I had seen Carlo with Mooney.
Oh, okay.
A bunch. But you know, I met Pat back then, and we kind of bonded over crazy shit that we liked.
Sure.
And then, as years went on, I mean, the last five records or something, that there's always at least one that we've co-written.
Nice.
You know, it's been the most fertile of my co-writing relations, you know.
You know, I wasn't aware that you had that kind of history with Pat, but thinking about it, it really makes a lot of sense because you guys have so many things in common, especially like the rhythmic approach, the roots approach. Like, you know, yeah. Pat has this thing where he'll set the verse up with something, you know, like very rhythmically propulsive, and he's an incredible rhythm guitar player, man. And like, just has such a yeah. pocket and a way.
Somehow or another, he bends his back the way that no other humans can bend their back.
Right, right, right.
And then
lifts his leg,
squeezes it out there. That's the greatest, man.
And go ahead.
No, my friend Cynthia, you know, my dear pal, she would tell me, well, there's music and then there's Pat. She had a little, almost like a little votive, there's like a little votive, tiny little picture of him from Unglued, from the back of Unglued.
Nice.
In a little frame that's been in our home throughout the time.
That's so funny. Yeah. So I was going to say, he'll like set up a verse with something that's real funky and rootsy sounding, and then the chorus will go to a related but not expected key change that will elevate the whole thing into this whole other, like, very major and even almost major seventh tonality, where it's like, wow, how'd you get there from where you just were? And it's like the skies open up, man, and you know, God shines his face on you, and then it's right back to this right. real gut bucket feel.
Yeah, man. What's that one? There's a million of them.
I always think of that time was silly boy. Where we used you to.
Getting everything that you wanted. Yeah. Now look at you.
Yeah, that's it. Now look at you. That's so great. Oh, it goes back into that. That kind of a flat seven groove. So good.
He's fantastic.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Well,
we did two on the record. The one called We Sure Got Enough, which is really in Doug Somm territory on the record.
Oh, yeah. And that's a brilliant thing. You have Derek playing the Rocky Morales part there. And the other guy's playing the Augie Myers part. Yeah, yeah. No, that's very successfully done, man. You got the Vox organ sound.
We had a great time doing that one. That actually was recorded in Milwaukee. That was one of the first ones we did for the record.
Okay.
And that's got Reggie on it playing drums.
Right. It's got Derek Houston playing saxophone. Mm-hmm.
Derek had come up to visit during the summer when we had just put it down, and so he went in and put his solo on there.
Nice.
And then he's on a few tracks.
Yeah, he's on a whole bunch of stuff here. Yeah. And all that stuff sounds great, you know. And again, Derek plays like he has such a command of rock and roll saxophone. You can play a song for him that's a new song, an original song, and you'll listen to it, and he can relate it to all the entire canon of rock and roll saxophone and synthesize something that's new that fits your thing, but it's totally based on everything that came before it. You know, it's completely rooted in the
tone is as big as a house, you know, no matter what. And I mean, it's such a gas. That's one of my favorite things on the record, is to hear him. That one you were talking about, Keep On Thinking or Keep On Looking Like That.
Right, right.
He's straight up, you know, Plaz Johnson, you know,
right?
Pink Panther land.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, and it was really, I mean, it's kind of as close. I'm a giant Five Royales fan, and that's as close as I've ever come to writing something that's sort of up that street.
Nice.
But, you know, it's just wonderful to hear him play on there, and also on the one called The Brink of Things, where there he's like doing the... what's our guy? Lee Allen.
Yeah. No, Derek is such a student of all that stuff, man. He's digested it in a way that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Or it's even King Curtis, like, on that song. Yeah. But the other Pat song is the last song on the record called Dreaming Back. We got a few more. That was one that I almost forgot for the record. Pat and I had it for probably 5 years or something. And I was going to the last day where we were going to all cut together in, at the room in Chicago. And I thought, oh, man, I never even thought of that one. So then I'm just so glad we did it. And that was like really a one, like we did three or four takes, but the first take, like the organ playing on it is, I love it. Bob plays beautifully.
Yeah, man.
Derek was coming to join us in the studio that day to maybe do some overdubbing or something. And he walked in the door while we were cutting that. And, you know, he was like, whoa, man. It was really fun.
It's so exciting when you're doing something, you can really feel the electrons moving around in a very special way, you know, and everybody's looking at each other like, oh, no, we're doing important work here. This is, we're doing God's work here.
I mean, you know, you're hoping, and you're hoping you have that kind of sense of it happening, you know, that that comes across rather than, like, really working it hard or trying. And I mean, that's really where the first take had it, and the later ones had me, you know, trying a little too hard or something.
Right. Sounds too thought out, or yeah, maybe everything's becoming a little bit contrived. Not that you're trying to, but, you know, it's
sure,
you can only, like they say, you only have one chance to make a first impression. And songs or performances do that similarly, you know, like there's only one time when you're going to play the song where you're not sure what's going to happen next.
That's true.
I mean, in the
you know,
the
and then you also
sense,
you're balancing. You know, like Mike, my bass player, he's a wonderful player. I kind of wanted to do the kind of the Nick Lowe plan of like of having the band not really know it well, but having him, he knows the song, how to play it on acoustic and sing it to the point where he doesn't feel like it sounds like him anymore. He wants it to be like that guy.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got it all down. So he's not even thinking about it. But he wants to get that kind of unsettled thing in the band.
Right.
And I like that idea, but I think Mike is not. Mike is like a guy that really wants to think the thing through and wants to make sure he's got it the way he wants it.
Uh-huh.
And so you got to have to work that balance of like making sure he's comfortable and having fun. But that was one where, you know, once we had it down, then we just put it down.
Yeah, like the like capturing the sense of wonder on tape, you know, like that's
that's tough.
The tape catches everything. That's the thing. It catches everything, man. It catches every good impulse, every false impulse. It reads your mind and then puts it out there for everyone.
to
consume for good or bad. Well, you know, you mentioned Cynthia, and the record is dedicated to Cynthia.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cynthia, I knew Cynthia maybe before I knew you. She used to live in New Orleans. She was a big Iguanas fan. She would come dance, you know.
Weekly.
A devoted dancer at Cafe Brazil when we played there, and what a beautiful person, what a sweet soul, and always someone super kind to me. And
we did have a wonderful thing, and I'm really so glad and so lucky to have been with her. And I've, you know, walking around here, I think about her, you know, all the things we did here, all the things we did everywhere,
right,
and all her ideas about music and about life and how to wear a shirt and, you know, everything.
Yeah. She had opinions about everything.
Yeah. And, you know, so they, we lost her in March of 24.
Right.
And, you know, it was a cancer thing, stomach cancer.
Mm.
But, you know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, someone is as alive as anyone you've ever known. And then, you know, they're gone, and you don't, I don't know.
There's no rhyme or reason to it.
No,
it's
no.
Inexplicable.
No, so I kind of wrestled. I mean, the record was really done, recorded before she was really very sick. But I wanted to somehow acknowledge it. At one point, I was going to call the record In Cynthia's World. And then, I don't know, I had a few friends that said, you may not want to have that be central to the
sure,
thing.
Sure.
So that's what I, my dedication in there is.
That's beautiful, man. No, that's beautiful. You know, one of the last memories, maybe the last time I saw Cynthia, we Iguanas played Shank Hall, and y'all came to see us, and we were hanging out after the gig for a long time, and you know, Cynthia is someone who's always very sweet to me. And, you know, I've been using this thin red, like, girls watch band for a few years.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, well, everyone will notice this, and nobody does. But Cynthia did. She goes, ooh, I like that watch band. I was like, okay, Cynthia, you get the prize because you're the first person in months to even notice it. But you know, she was, that's the kind of person she was, you know, just nothing escaped her. And
she, you know, could have probably told you who made that one.
Yeah, right, right, right. Oh, man. God, Paul, well, you know, it's, you made such a terrific record here, and you
thank
should be
you,
so
Renee.
Proud.
And it's out on a label out of New York called Story Sound.
Yes.
And it just came out in September, and we're going to have it be the new record for as long as we possibly can.
Sure, yeah, yeah, it just came
we're really,
out.
We're really trying to get it. I mean, I had to go down to the Music Factory and make sure they had it in.
Got to do it, man.
Yeah.
And, well, I guess you must be either have a new booking agent or shopping for a new booking agent, since our longtime booking agent just left the business. That's the thing. You know, if you stay in the business long enough, everybody that you got into it with leaves, and you're right. Like, you got to start over.
Yeah, we're the ones out on the curb trying to figure it out.
But, you know, here you and I, we're not starting over. It's just a continuation. And, you know, when I think about this in terms of, like, clubs that I played, you know, like, clubs start and you do great business there, and then either they close or they don't like you anymore, they quit using you for what, you know, somebody gets in a beef, I don't know, who knows what happened, you know, a million things
can
happen.
Or they get a new booking agent. For the club.
And, yeah. And and I always think, look, I played a million jobs before I ever met you. I will play a million jobs after you. It's not, I'm not.
Or at least a half a million.
You know, I don't know. I think that the speaker has the privilege of hyperbole. So,
yes.
It's not an actual million, but it's thousands.
Yes.
I will play thousands of jobs.
Right.
From here on out.
Yes.
You know, God willing. But you know, it's something you got to take in stride. But so you guys have plans. You're touring. I've seen you've gotten a lot of coverage already on this. You had the first three songs on the record were all the singles that you put out, which all sounded beautiful.
Yeah. It was. It's been fun to have someone that cares about your record as much as you do.
Right.
You know, that's a great thing.
Right. And, and that's for the
for
record company,
Story Sound.
Story Sound. Right on. Where are they based out of?
They're on the Lower East Side in New York.
Nice. My favorite part of New York.
There's a guy named Dick Connett.
Alphabet City.
Yeah, they're probably, I guess it would be considered Soho. He's been there a long time.
Okay.
There's a guy named Dick Connett, who's I met down here actually at Jazz Fest years and years ago, but never knew I'd be working with him. But he's a great guy. And he at the time had a band called The Last Forever. They did kind of orchestral folk music, and they had a record on Nonesuch.
Okay.
And I remember he since has done it. He did a record for his own label called Too Sad for the Public. That's what the band is called. But he's a very kind of darkly droll guy.
Nice.
And a real fan of the people on his label. He's got a bunch of records by Loudon Wainwright.
Oh, sure.
And then a gal named Anna Ege. He's done a number of records with her. And he kind of works with the Suzzy Roach and her daughter. He's done a record there. And they did a record that double record of Maggie's songs when Maggie died. They did a really nice Maggie Roach compilation record.
Nice. Well, that sounds like a good place for you to be, man.
Yeah, I mean, that's. I have more relations to some of those acts than one would think.
Sure. No, I can see it. Yeah, I can see it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we're probably their only dance band, so.
Right. They need one.
That's good.
You know?
Yeah.
They need, you know, like everybody thinks that that's the cliche thing from American Bandstand. It's got a good beat. You can dance to it.
That's right. Or like Eugene Levy said, boss school.
Yeah.
Boss age. Yeah.
All right, Paul. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up here, huh? Unless you have anything else to...
I don't know.
Words of wisdom for
I think we're pretty well there. But please come out if you see him. We're coming to town. Come see
us. Yeah, look out for Paul Seabar and Tomorrow Sound. And check out the record, Paul Seabar.
Yeah.
Aptly titled.
Yeah.
Paul, I love you so much, man.
Thanks, Renee.
And
Manny's not here to counter that.
Yeah, well, he would have bailed out a while ago over all this. Just kind of talk that I won't even characterize what he would have said. But I am Renee Coleman for Manny Chevrolet and our guest Paul Seabar signing off from Inside the Feral Zone. And
struggle.
Happy New Year, everyone. The struggle continues in the new year. Good night.
Evelyn working is dressed like his car. It's a candy red jacket and a sissy bar. Mr. Jazz is riding too with his burnished fringe on the matte black tip. And it's off to fall just before the color. Sickly slide. We're hovering, coming, and thinking why. On this Sunday ride, we squirt out of summer in its torpid grip. On the highway and its aimless trip. Motor City is calling. Welcome in time. And it's off to fall just before the color and the sickly slide. We're swinging, burning, thinking why. On a Sunday ride, cards hit high, everything's hanging on. It'll be bonfires and jackets and dragging along. Now it's shirt sleeves and a red new breeze in a flickin' green tie. And it's off to fall just before the colors and the sickly slide. We're floating, whining, and thinking why. On this Sunday ride, mighty tear on the mock, Memphis stomp on the side. Sunday ride. On a Sunday ride. On a Sunday ride. On a Sunday ride. Sunday.